Morning, Council. We have one case scheduled for argument this morning, and we understand everyone's appeared and announced ready, so we'll call the case now. Parker County Squaw Creek Downs LP, James R. Dunnigan versus Joseph Earl Watson et al.
May I please report, Mr. David Cook and Mr. David Stantz will argue for opponents, Mr. Robert Myers will argue for appellee.
Mr. Cook?
Thank you for your time this morning. Here on behalf of the limited partner, acting on behalf of Parker County Squaw Creek Downs, by and through its general partner. Based on the filings that have been made in this case by the by Mr. Watson, one of the first questions I believe it's necessary to answer here this morning is does Parker County 3, Inc. have the authority to act? And I believe the answer to that question is yes.
Could you address jurisdiction first, if you will?
Okay. Jurisdiction on which issue?
Well, the jurisdiction we have or don't have over this appeal. Is this an appealable order?
I think that's a good question. We believe that the court in Parker County has acted without authority. We believe that the order that the Parker County judge issued was outside his plenary power when he issued the order for the appointment of the receiver.
It appears, or an argument could be made that it's the judge was just performing. You might say his ministerial act and just enforcing his own judgment, in which case that would not be an appealable order, would it?
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so,
I believe in this.
So why isn't that what we have here?
The reason is because this requested relief was requested by Mr. Watson at the trial court level and was denied at the trial court level. And then after it went up on appeal, it came back and the mandate was issued by this court, general partner effected the dissolution. Mr. Watson did not like the dissolution and therefore made a request for the appointment of a receiver some 4 years later. And I believe that was outside the court's plenary power at that time because the issue had been raised, litigated, and denied at the trial court level and was not appealed by Mr. Watson or by Mr. Dunnigan or any of the entities. And therefore...
Well, if there had not been a dissolution or an attempted dissolution... Would you consider this an order to enforce the judgment?
No, Your Honor. The reason is because of the limited partnership. Because the limited partnership agreement sets forth the basis or the direction that the entity was to follow pursuant to the court's order. The court's order said to dissolve in accordance with the limited partnership agreement, and that's what happened. And then Mr. Watson came back after the mandate, asked for the appointment of the receiver, and I believe stated that that was outside the court's authority. And I believe, therefore, that the order was void because the issue had been litigated on res judicata principles. It had been litigated, decided, and not appealed. May I proceed?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. With regard to the question as to whether or not Parker County 3 has the authority to act, as stated, I believe the answer is yes, that based on the fact that the corporate rights and privileges have been reinstated, I know this court recently, with Justice Livingston writing the opinion in the Gray West matter, had a similar issue. And obviously the cases are very distinguishable. In Gray West, there was no evidence, as stated in the opinion, there was no evidence that Gray West LLC ever took the steps necessary to revive its Texas charter. There was no evidence at the trial court level to that effect, and the appellant offered no evidence to prove this in his pleadings or raise it at the abatement hearing at the trial court level. And in this case, in the attachments to Mr. Dunnigan's reply brief that was filed with the court on October 6, 2008. Those documents are are attached, and it does show that the application for reinstatement was received by the Secretary of State and found to conform with the law of the Texas Secretary of State and was approved, and therefore Parker County 3 Inc. has been reinstated to active status on the records of the Secretary of State. We just now brought those to the court's attention based upon the issue, this being the first time this issue was raised. This issue is raised for the first time by Mr. Watson. It was not complained of or raised at the trial court level. And so that was another distinction in this case, as opposed to the case that Justice Livingston wrote on previously, is that in the Gray West case, that was basically the issue. And I believe that both the trial court and this Court of Appeals did the only thing, made the only alternative really that was available, because the plaintiff was given alternatives even by the defendant in that case at the trial court level. That was the purpose of the abatement, was to allow the plaintiff to amend its pleadings, and it never took that action, and also admitted at the trial court level and at the Court of Appeals that it had other proper parties, and basically I believe in that case it was no harm, no foul. He refiled in his individual name, if I recall. Next question is, what action has Parker County 3 taken in this case? And basically the action that's been taken is that based on the partnership agreement, they're authorized to perform the dissolution, and based on that authority, they accomplished the dissolution, and then they also bind through the general partner hired myself to accomplish the dissolution. That question has been raised as well, and I believe that the next question that's been raised by the by Mr. Watson is that just because it's been reinstated, it doesn't revert back, and I believe that the law is very, very clear. In the briefing, there's a case, Hinkle, that clearly states that that it does revert back. And even in, we do not agree that this case falls under the Texas Business Corporation Act. But even under that act, under Chapter 7, even if you apply the statute under that case, you still have a reversion. It reverts back if you apply within the 36 months. We believe that in this case, the charter was not forfeited. The charter was forfeited by the Secretary of State, but there was not an order entered by and through the Texas Secretary of State, which is what happens when it's forfeited by order under Chapter 7. In this case, we simply received a notice from the Texas Secretary of State that the charter had been forfeited based upon the failure to file the franchise tax reports. And once that issue was, once it was brought to the attention of the partnership, then those reports and those taxes were properly filed and paid. And so that, to me, that answers the question as to whether or not the authority and myself had the ability to go forward with the appeal. The next argument that I believe has also been made by Mr. Watson is that 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 even if we had the authority to act, just a moment. That we did not have the authority to appeal the appointment of a receiver. And I believe that argument is absurd, in that if you just take a common sense approach or look at that, that would mean that any time in any case a receiver is appointed, that the property owner would not have the right to appeal that order, which is basically what Mr. Watson is alleging in this case. The appeal has been perfected by the partnership with regard to the appointment of a receiver, and Mr. Watson's position is that only the receiver could appeal the appointment of himself, which, again, I believe lacks merit. And then the last issue I wanted to cover, this is kind of the first issue that the court asked about, and I believe that based on the principles of res judicata, like I said, this issue was raised and litigated at the trial court level. It was in the pleadings and also objected to at the time the judgment was entered by Mr. Watson. And at that time, the issue of appointment of a receiver was denied. We also believe that the order appointing the receiver is void because it's outside the post-plenary power of the court. We do believe it goes far outside the bounds of whether or not the court was simply enforcing its order.
But when a court is enforcing its order, especially one that, you know, lasts over time, because obviously things like this can't be done instantaneously, I mean, can't circumstances change such that the final judgment allows a trial court some flexibility in enforcing its judgment?
Not if the partnership agreement is contrary, in our opinion. In our opinion, the parties contracted this. Partnership agreement was drafted by Mr. Watson's attorney. It provided the events that were to take place in the event of a dissolution. The order said to dissolve it in conjunction with the partnership agreement, and that's what's been done. This dissolution has already been accomplished. Deeds have been filed with regard to the property. It's been completed. There's no reason to have the appointment of a receiver. Also wanted to point out that basically I believe that the legislative intent or the purpose of the charter being forfeited in this case under the tax code is a revenue driven provision. It's obviously the purpose of the Secretary of State forfeiting it is when it receives a notice from the comptroller's office that this particular entity has not filed its report and paid its taxes, then the charter is forfeited. And then at any time, there's not a 36-month window under the tax code, only under the Texas Business Corporation Act. Under the tax code, there is no such restriction. There's not a 36-month limitation or time limitation. It says at any time you can go back and file your reports and pay your taxes, and that's what happened in this case. And based upon that provision of the tax code, it's clear that the purpose of the tax code provision is to collect, you know, the revenue for the state of Texas. And Mr. Spence will handle the remaining issues on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Myers?
May it please the court, Your Honors. First of all, on behalf of Mr. Watson, I want to thank the court for putting us on a kind of an accelerated schedule, because if there was ever a case that cries out for resolution, this one is it. In the some 2 years now that I've been involved in this case, solely trying to get Judge Vick's judgment in Parker County enforced. And I have talked to other lawyers who I respect, other judges not associated with the case, obviously, and lay people, and I'm struck by the similarities of the response that they all have. How can something like this happen? How can you have a jury trial that we're coming up on the six-year anniversary of in February? How can you have an appeal clear to the Supreme Court? This court, Justice Holman wrote the opinion, handed down their opinion over 2 years ago. Why is the case still going on? My only explanation, and the only thing that I can tell the people who I talk to, is because our judgment opponent just simply doesn't care what the court says. He is going to do what he is going to do, regardless of what the court tells him to do, until finally, last summer, Judge Vick put his foot down and he said, you're going to comply with my judgment, and here is how you're going to do it, after a full evidentiary hearing. So the question, it seems to me, is very, very simple. And I know that there are a lot of collateral side roads in this matter, but it seems to me that it is this simple. Did Judge Vick have the authority to do what he did this summer? And the answer, of course, is a resounding yes. For the very reasons that this court articulated, and I believe it was the case was Denton County against Tarrant County, when a court merely undertakes to enforce its judgment, that order is not even reviewable on appeal. Now, I suppose arguably it is reviewable on an abuse of discretion standard by way of mandamus, which Mr. Dunnigan has also brought. So if that's the case, then the question is, did Judge Vick abuse his discretion? Was he acting without reference to any guiding principles? And that hasn't, frankly, been suggested by my learned opponents. The only thing that they tell you is that Judge Vick did what he did, A, out of time, and B, contrary to the terms of the judgment which he signed in September of 2004.
Well, now, another question I have is, why did Judge Vick believe it necessary to enforce a judgment when, as the appellants, relators have contended, the part of the judgment that he was attempting to enforce had already been effectuated?
Yeah, I concede that they have made that argument, and it can be facially compelling. However, I think it's also important to understand that at the point in time when Judge Vick finally acted, it was a year after he had heard the evidence the year before. And what he said at the second hearing I thought was pretty telling. He said, if I had made a decision that day, he said it twice. He said it right at the beginning and right at the end. He said, if I'd have made a decision that day, I'd appointed a receiver. You know, I thought that's what the evidence demonstrated needed to have happen. Okay? I didn't do it because Mr. Dunnigan had run over here to Fort Worth and filed another lawsuit in Lynn Wade's court asking Judge Wade to throw holy water over what he had done out there in Parker County. And the sole question in his pleadings in Tarrant County were, did I comply with the Parker County's judgment? Now, that's just ridiculous. I mean, I'm sorry, but that is blatant forum shopping in its game plan, and it shouldn't be rewarded. But Judge Vick, in deference to Judge Wade, did not at that time abate the case. He has now. But at that time, he did not. And this court will remember, I went up on a mandamus. Judge Livingston would have granted it. I believe it was Judge Casey and Judge Holman who were also on that panel who denied it without comment. So did the Supreme Court. Okay. Once all of that was done, Judge Vick ruled. And it seems to me, Judge Casey, to specifically answer your question, he must have concluded that they weren't complying with his judgment by whatever it was that they had done, which, of course, he was free to do.
What's the evidence of that?
Well, we had a full evidentiary
hearing. That they weren't complying with the judgment?
We had a full evidentiary hearing over there, Judge.
Now, I'm asking you, though, counsel. I mean, I haven't had a chance to read the
sure.
full record, but I'm just wondering, what evidence is there that there was noncompliance with the judgment after the dissolution was effected per the vote of the partnership?
In my briefing, I think, in fact, I'm sure, that I set out some bullet points about what it was that Judge Vick heard.
Well, I understand there's some disagreement about how the partnership property was distributed or allocated.
Or even whether it was capable of distribution in kind, or even whether that was an available remedy, or even whether it was truly Dunnigan who testified, I'm the one that did it, and whether the Partnership Act precludes that, which I think clearly it does. They keep saying they want to read this judgment. As Judge Livingston said in an opinion, it was the Anderson against it was a restaurant down here on 7th Street. And she said, this court said, you've got to read a judgment as a whole. You've got to give meaning and effect to all of its terms. The way they want to read the judgment is, they said, you've got to dissolve this partnership just on the basis of the partnership agreement. Okay? If I take that even as true, they still ignore that part of the partnership agreement which says that it in this particular circumstance, as we briefed, it needs to be dissolved with the help of a receiver.
But the judgment itself says that the partnership shall be dissolved, and I quote, in accordance with the limited partnership agreement.
And the applicable provisions of the partnership
and
Act.
And those applicable provisions of the Act.
Sure. And the reason why that's important is this. The jury also found, in response to jury question number 8, that it was Dunnigan's actions that made continuation of the partnership not practicable, I believe is the statutory language. Based on that, the Partnership Act precludes Mr. Dunnigan from being the one to effectuate the dissolution. Why? Well, think about it. It makes perfect sense. Why should someone whose actions have caused the partnership to be involuntarily dissolved be the one that gets to make the decisions? I think it's fair to assume that a person in that position is not likely to be fair to the other partners. So he's precluded, and yet he did it. Now, he's tried to hide behind the defunct corporation. I'll get to that in a minute if I have time. I think that the corporation did not exist at the time that all of these acts that we're complaining about occurred. I think it was thus without authority for the reasons that we cited in our most recent response, to hire Mr. Cook, to enter into contracts, to give Mr. Dunnigan a secured lien for $600,000+ on the partnership property 5 days before this court's mandate issued. That the corporation didn't exist at that time. It couldn't contract. It had no rights. And you can't revive it now and have it relate back and make those acts valid, as Judge Livingston observed in the Gray West case recently. And it makes no sense that it would be the case otherwise, because what they're trying to tell you is the corporation can be defunct, I suppose, into perpetuity for 50 years. And undertake all these acts and do all these things, and then someday, 50 days later, somebody pays the franchise taxes and it gets reinstated. Everything that it did for the last half century is somehow validated. That's not the law. What it does during that 3-year window of opportunity may be revived if it revives within that 3-year period, but if it doesn't, then it's just gone. It may revive itself in some other fashion on a go-forward basis, but it can't go back. So, but I don't think you have to get there. I don't think you have to get there in order to approve of what Judge Vick did. Because I think clearly, at the end of the day, all he's doing is saying, I conducted a hearing, I determined that my judgment wasn't being complied with, and I'm going to do something to enforce it. And, of course, this court knows, that it certainly shouldn't substitute its own judgment for that of Judge Vick. He certainly felt confident that what he was doing was right, I would assume, or he didn't do it. And unless there is some legal impediment to him doing so, which I do not find, and the only thing that my learned opponents argue is that he was out of time, which we know is not the case because, as the late Justice Baker said in Griner against Jameson, the trial court can enforce its judgments at any time if it finds it's not that they're not being complied with in the exercise of the protection of its jurisdiction. So that argument fails. So the only question then is, was what Judge Vick did at odds with the literal terms of the judgment which he entered? And the answer is no. A receiver is specifically contemplated and provided for under both the Partnership Act and the Partnership Agreement. And
is there any detrimental effect, though, by not having the receiver in this cause of action then?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
In other words, the receiver was not made a party to this cause of action. Do we need the receiver here?
I hadn't really considered that question, Judge. The receiver, as I understand it in this particular circumstance, I mean, this isn't a prejudgment receivership where there's a bond required. The parties' relative rights relative to one another have been determined by way of a final judgment. The way I view it, and I hope the way Judge Vick views it, and I hope the way this court views it, is that what has happened since then is merely an effort to enforce that judgment. So in that regard, I suppose just on the fly, if I thought about it, it's as if Mr. Hill is really acting as an arm of the court in this instance. And a review, I believe, of the order that Judge Vick signed appointing Mr. Hill will bear that out.
So really at this point the receiver has no assets yet because the receiver hasn't gained control of any assets or located any assets.
That's correct, Judge. We
and some of that was taken up, I guess, in that hearing as to what has happened with the partnership assets.
It was, and frankly, in deference to this court and their efforts to come here and have, you know, what was going on down there vetted, we agreed. I agreed on behalf of Mr. Watson, and Mr. Hill agreed, you know, not to do anything until, you know, you all had an opportunity to look it over and make a decision.
You're talking about in this pending this appeal?
Yes. Yes, or the mandamus action. I'm not sure the mandamus action was pending at the time that we had the hearing. The second hearing in front of Judge Vick on the motion to reconsider.
How would all of what has taken place in dissolving the partnership be undone?
Well, very simply, in the receiver's discretion. By the way, the only thing that's happened is that Dunnigan has cut deeds to himself and to my client. My client hasn't filed any deeds. My client doesn't recognize the validity of what Dunnigan's done. There's just two parties. Well, I'm sorry, there's three. There's Lawley, who... Judge Holman's opinion said he didn't own anything, but apparently owned some 1% of something. But anyway, he had some small de minimis role. But really the only two involved are Watson and Dunnigan, the two principals. So there is not going to be any. And by the way, we filed a list pendants on that property out there years ago. So if anybody has taken title of that property with notice that this litigation is going on, they do so at their own risk. I don't think that's happened. As I said, it's a single-purpose property. I'm sure Your Honor's probably driven by it a dozen times. It's the racetrack out there on the way to Weatherford.
You were about to say the receiver would do what to these deeds?
I would say that the receiver would vet them and to see whether or not they were signed, first of all, with authority, and secondly, in accordance with the court's judgment, and if they're not, would move to set those them aside.
So there'd be more litigation, is what you're saying.
Well, likely. Given the proclivities of, and I like these two fellows, they're fine lawyers, but I'm not as fond of their client. And given his proclivities over the last few years, I dare say that I think we could expect more litigation. I don't know how to avoid that, Judge. I just don't. I think we go a long way toward avoiding it. And perhaps bring everybody to the table with a sense of reason when Mr. Dunnigan understands that the court is not going to tolerate him simply thumbing his nose at the court and saying, I'm going to do what I'm going to do no matter what you say. That hasn't happened until this summer when Judge Vick told him, this is what we're going to do. Now, as you can see, he didn't accept that at face value either. I'm out of time. I appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Mr. Spence.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court. Your Honor, Your Honors and Chief Justice, let me answer your first question that you asked, Mr. Cook. We did file a writ of mandamus as a backstop in this case, but I think the reason that this order is appealable is because it is more than mere enforcement of the 2004 judgment. Justice Livingston, you are correct. Trial courts have much flexibility in enforcing their own orders, but what they can't do under the law is they can't enter an enforcement order after their plenary power has expired that is actually inconsistent with the judgment or changes what is called material adjudicated portions of the judgment. And our position is simply this. The judgment in 2004 in paragraph 5, which says dissolve this partnership pursuant to the terms of the partnership agreement and those applicable provisions of the act, gave the general partner the direct authority to do what it did in this case, and that was do a distribution in kind. And that's what was accomplished. And that leads directly to our point of why the appointment of a receiver, first and foremost, is not mere enforcement, and that it's also moot, that there is no dispute in the evidence in this case that an 11.5 distribution in kind was accomplished and has been effectuated. And it was more than mere distribution of deeds. It was a relinquishment of Mr. Watson's the judgment against him for breaching fiduciary duties in the original lawsuit. It was an assignment of a bill of sale of the assets. Mr. Dunnigan received and assumed the liabilities. It's been a complete distribution of the assets and liabilities of the partnership. So our position is that a court-appointed receiver, many years after the 2004 judgment, was not mere enforcement, that it was inconsistent with the original judgment and changed material terms of the judgment. Here's what I think this case is really about. In the original lawsuit, there was a dispute between Dunnigan and Watson over majority ownership of not only the corporate general partner but the limited partnership. And about 3 months before the trial of the case, Mr. Watson eventually conceded that Mr. Dunnigan had majority ownership. And then 7 days before trial, Mr. Watson amended his pleadings and said, "I want to dissolve this partnership." I will bet the farm that at that time, Mr. Watson did not remember that the limited partnership agreement he signed, that his lawyers drafted, had a provision in there that said, upon dissolution, the general partner may make a property-by-property distribution in kind at the sole discretion of the general partner. And so what happened in this case, we appealed respectfully Judge Holman's decision, and the Supreme Court rejected it. And within weeks after that, we went and dissolved the corporation pursuant to the terms of the limited partnership agreement and conducted a distribution in kind. And that's what happened. And we went and filed a lawsuit in Tarrant County. And by the way, we're being accused of forum shopping, but our limited partnership agreement says that's where we're supposed to file it. The irony of that argument is this original lawsuit filed by Mr. Watson was a true example of forum shopping because he went and filed it in Parker County contrary to the terms of the limited partnership agreement. But I digress. And so the point in this case is simply the partnership was dissolved and distributed in kind pursuant to the terms of the partnership agreement. Mr. Watson doesn't like that and wanted a court-appointed receiver because he thinks he'll get a better deal. But the point is, and as we cite in our brief, the terms of the partnership agreement control the agreement between the parties. Mr. Watson can't simply retrade his deal. If he really feels that the distribution was unfair, he can litigate that issue in the Tarrant County proceeding. And then finally, the last thing I'll say about this forfeiture of corporate charter, we laid out in our reply brief how this works, but I think it is important to note that 701 of the Business Corporations Act, especially A and B, deal with involuntary dissolution by order of the Secretary of State. That didn't occur here. The 36-month window that applies only applies when that type of dissolution occurs. Here, where you have a forfeiture of a corporate charter under the tax code, even though it may be defined as a dissolved corporation under Chapter 7, the definition says unless that corporate charter is being reinstated, and therefore it wasn't a dissolved corporation once that happened, and the case law has always been clear, and Chapter 7 has not changed it, that forfeiture of a corporate charter is retroactive as if it never, once it's reinstated, is retroactive as if it never occurred.
Mr. Spence, yes. if the court's order was upheld, what would be the harm to your client?
Well, I think the harm to my client would be, number one, that it wouldn't be entitled to avail itself of the contractual agreement that it entered into and should control between the parties. And in that regard, the distribution in kind that is allowed by the general partner at the general partner's sole discretion is what it is. My client would have no control over his partnership interest in the event a court-appointed receiver is brought in to do whatever. And of course at this point it's not even clear how that would occur or what would happen. That's a fluid obviously point.
Well, you mean we don't know what the receiver might do?
That's right.
Assuming the receiver just followed the partnership agreement and distributing the assets.
Well, I think then the issue would be that my client had a majority ownership interest in the corporate general partner, and under law, he's entitled to exercise those majority rights. Our opponent makes it out to be that, oh my gosh, if you have a majority interest and therefore can make the decisions, that somehow that's inherently unfair or wrong. But partnerships, every limited partnerships, operate that way. And Mr. Watson conceded that majority ownership to us in the underlying lawsuit and never challenged that finding.
So it would be a violation or the loss of that right under the partnership agreement?
Absolutely.
That would be the harm that you would?
Yes.
Anything else?
Well, I haven't really thought in those terms.
Okay. Well, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Court appreciates all counsel appearing here this morning to present your arguments. It's been very helpful. We have no other cases to hear, so this case will be submitted, and we'll ask the clerk to adjourn us. Thank you.